welcome to another episode of The Dawn of Shades. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and today is March 20th, 2012. This just also happens to be National Ravioli Day. Woohoo! So what's your favorite kind of ravioli? I like mine stuffed with feta cheese, kale, and sausage. Now for tonight's program, just like all programs, I would love to have the audience's input with questions and comments. So if you've joined the virtual auditorium in Pal Talk, you can send them to me via text. Or if you are listening through one of the other venues, you can email them to me at gscott@exogenynetwork.com. Our guests also have pages on our website. Just click on their names in the left-hand column, and you can go straight there. Our listeners can also find our guest list, and you will know then who was on which show. There's lots of great information that can be found there, as well as links to blogs, Facebook, Twitter, and my favorite, Google+. For all of our fans that are also foodies, we've got a fun project coming up as we put together a cookbook, so be sure to go to the website and find out how to submit a recipe yourself. Now, we're going to be holding a drawing next week during our anniversary show, so get those recipes in. Each submission is worth one entry. We still haven't decided what we'll be offering as a prize yet, but I'll guarantee one thing. It's not going to be anything big enough that you have to worry about paying taxes on it. It's still sure to be something that anyone who cooks or eats will love. Now, our guest tonight is J.C. Johnson, a researcher into the paranormal and cryptozoology of the Four Corners region, which just so happens to include the Navajo Nation. Sort of a sidebar to that little tidbit, keep in mind that Native American Voices is a spring series here on the Dawn of Shades, and it will start on April 10th with Mike Graham and the topic of the Indian Holocaust. So don't miss it. The series will run from April 10th to June 5th. Now, with that said, JC, would you introduce yourself to the audience members that may not have heard you on previous appearances?
Absolutely a pleasure to be here. My third visit on Dawn of Shades. I think three times is a charm.
Yep.
At least I heard.
So, tell everybody a little bit about who JC Johnson is and what you're doing with Crypto Four Corners.
I did kind of a brief synopsis. I've been a outdoor guide for over 20 years, off and on. River guide, outdoor guide, hunting guide, fishing guide. I'm a terrible golfer. Let's see. I mean, we started running into stuff about 1999 that we couldn't explain over on the Mogollon Rim. I think our first experience there that was just really horrific. Was with a creature called the Blue Ridge Banshee, we named later, and it turns out the Blue Ridge Banshee was probably a Sasquatch. I'm 99% convinced of that, but that really opened my eyes and my mind that we were sharing something on this planet that we couldn't explain. So that's where I got my start with all of the high strange weirdness.
Yeah, you know, and listening to some of the videos you have up on YouTube, which, by the way, everybody, search on YouTube for Crypto Four Corners, and there's lots and lots of videos. There's also a bunch of videos on both J.C. Johnson's page on our website, as well as on Leonard Dan's page on our website, which Leonard Dan's also appeared on the program before, and he's worked with J.C. on a number of occasions. But, you know, I was listening to the audio of the whoops and stuff that you had. It reminded me of occasions on which I had heard those same sounds. You know, for anybody who's not an outdoorsy kind of person, imagine being a single mother. You take your kids camping out in a fairly remote area of the Apache Sitgreaves National Forest. You know, you're sleeping in a tent. You don't have a gun. You don't have a dog. I mean, you're just out here. I mean, nothing's going to get you, right? You have your little campfire, you know, and so forth and so on. And you go to bed, you wake up to hearing the elk bugling, because they bugle and they are loud. If you've never heard it, it's quite an interesting sound. And you hear the elk bugling, and then you hear a wolf pack howling off in the distance. And wolves have a very distinct sound from coyotes. You may also hear coyotes, and they have this yippity-yip-yip sound. And so you're listening to these sounds, and then you got, you know, your other little sounds of the night, which are small animals moving around in the trees and on the ground. And maybe you'll hear something walking past, and you don't know if it's a deer or an elk or the boogeyman, or what you're hearing exactly. And you hear insects and so forth and so on. And then just to punctuate the night, you're hearing these whoops that are attributed to Bigfoot or Sasquatch or, you know, the furry ones, whatever name you want to give them, this large hairy hominid anyhow. And you're like that. And then the final kicker, this is the one that will guarantee that the hair on the back of your neck is going to stand up, is the scream of a mountain lion echoing through the canyons. There is nothing that will arouse primal fear like the scream of a mountain lion. Yeah, I don't know. Do you think the whoops of a Bigfoot are scarier than the little scream of a lion, JC?
I would have to put the mountain lion above the sound of the furry ones.
Yeah.
I would have to, especially close by. I remember at one time, and you being familiar with Arizona, I'd taken my canoe and I had a small outboard on it, and I put in at the landing at Lake Pleasant. I went all the way back through the big chop, the big waves. You know, you got capsized, you're the big old twin turbo diesel houseboats and stuff like that. And, you know, I'm just trying to make my way back to Humbug Bay, and it's a no-wake zone. And you can go really, really deep into this area, especially in a canoe. There's areas where, you know, boats can't go. I can pull the prop up out of the water, paddle over some shallow areas, and drop back into deep pools and really get back there deep into areas where no one's going to bother me, and I can have some peace and quiet and some tranquility or whatever. And on one particular occasion, I got back there, Humbug Bay, got all settled in, got the tent up, and I heard that scream, and it was a cougar, and it came in really close to me. As I got darker, I remember laying there in my tent trying to sleep, and it was walking circles around me, and I could hear the footfalls, and I could hear the purr, breath kind of thing going on, you know, like when a cat breathes and purrs at the same time. It was that close to me. And I didn't want to harm the animal. I thought, you know, I'm going to lay here and just be ready and not harm this animal. But, I slept with a 40 caliber pistol in my right hand, 9mm Derringer in my left hand. And that's how I finally fell asleep. And when I got up the next morning, this cougar had beaten a perfect circle path around my tent about 20 or 30 feet out. So
yeah,
we both kind of stood each other down. I didn't engage. The cougar, I would say it was a she. I'm saying it was a female. That's my gut.
Uh-huh.
But we didn't engage each other. She just beat a path around the outer circle all night.
Uh-huh.
All night.
It's funny. You know, one of the first times that I saw a cougar in the wild, we're crawling up a road in the Apache Sitgreaves Forest, again, in a Jeep with no top on, and there's a cliff face right beside the road running up. And you look up, you know, through the topless roof of the Jeep, and lo and behold, lounging there on a branch hanging over the road that I'm on is the cougar. And I think cougars hunt. They like to drop on their prey. To my ego, he's like, let's go. Yeah. They do like up on them. And they're frequently found where there's lots of elk, and the Muggy Young Rim has a lot of elk.
Yes, they do.
And they're big. I remember the first time I saw an elk, I thought, oh my God, that's the biggest deer I have ever seen. They are the size of a horse, literally.
Well, you add a longer neck and you add antlers to the Roosevelt elk, and the Roosevelt elk are the largest elk in the world, and that's what you've got over there on the Mogollon Rim, and going in a little bit into northern Arizona, some of the Roosevelt elk have found their way off even into the Carrizos, and then over into New Mexico, they've done some release programs also. You've got a smaller elk up in Wyoming and Yosemite and those other areas. The largest elk in the world are right here in the Four Corners. They're humongous.
Yes, they are. They are literally humongous. They're quite tasty, I will admit, though. They are very good to eat, I think. Not everybody's crazy about elk meat, but I think elk meat is absolutely wonderful. And cougars happen to agree with me. They think it's wonderful, too.
Cougars and everything else that would prey on a large meat animal.
Right. Now, you know, as far as the wolves go, now I know that the Forest Service employee that I inquired about the wolves after I heard them, and they're like, oh, that wasn't a wolf. We don't have any. What you heard was a coyote. Well, come on. I'm not stupid. I have heard wolves and I've heard coyotes, and, you know, I can tell the difference. They don't sound anything alike. I know what I heard was a wolf pack. I also heard a coyote pack in a different area later, you know, later that same night. You know, so I don't know if it was straight out of where they were supposed to be or what the deal was on them, but I know it was wolves of some kind. Whether they were timber wolves or the Mexican red wolf or what, I don't know. But they weren't officially in the Apache Sitgreaves anyhow.
Well, that's another thing, too, is a lot of this stuff that we're running into, I'm running into, over the years has not been reintroduced. It's made its way back to its own territory. They're reclaiming territories outside of any help from mankind or game and fish or any other entity. They're coming back all on their own. Mm-hmm. We've got some great game cam photos of Red Wolf up on the Lucachucas. Beautiful animal. Gorgeous. And it's not reintroduced. It's not the Mexican gray wolf that's running around with collars. It's not some half-breed something-something wolf. This is a just an interesting-looking red wolf. Gorgeous.
Uh-huh.
And they're making their way back on their own. The grizzlies are coming back to the Lukachukai Mountains slowly. They've already made their way into the Chuska Mountains. I've been tracking that for a long time. And they've come down from Colorado and reclaim their areas here. And they're not recognized by game and fish, nor will they admit that they're in the area. But I talked to the sheep herders, and they are seeing these large humpbacked bears that stand 9 feet tall. They're seeing them, and they know what black bear look like and everything else. The descriptions I'm getting is definitely a grizzly.
Uh-huh. I have to admit, bears are the one thing I have a healthy phobia of. I had a couple of encounters in the Apache Sitgreaves. There happened to be in the area I like to spend time in. There also happened to be a sow bear who lived there, who was notoriously ill-tempered even before she started having cubs and didn't improve when she started having cubs. And she would chase vehicles, you know, on the road and everything, too. And she came in sheep one time. Now, if anybody has ever paid any attention to information about bears, bears can run to up to 35 miles an hour for a short distance. If you were driving on some of these Forest Service roads in these this backcountry, even in a four-wheel drive Jeep, 35 miles an hour is a speed you wouldn't even dream of trying to drive. Add in the fact that most of the time you're going to be having no top or a fabric top, that's not much protection from a bear. Yeah, so bears do scare me, especially if they're foul-tempered. This bear had, at that point, had never attacked anybody, but she put the fear of the bear species into many people's minds because she did chase you. She chased you on four-wheel drive or the little four-wheelers. You know, she didn't care. She just wanted you to leave. And she was good at making you leave, too. I'll admit that, too. She came up out of a canyon after us. When I first saw her at the bottom of the canyon, when you're standing looking down, something moving looks like a black ant. You can't really identify for sure what species it is, especially if it's moving slowly. It isn't moving fast enough to tell you, you know, what kind of gait it is and therefore what animal it is. So I didn't know if it was a cow, an elk, or what until she started coming up the canyon wall. And then it was like, ah, that's a bear, let's go. That's how she was leaving. She actually got within probably 50 yards of us.
Do you think this was a time when she had cubs, or was it just her general nature?
She was alone then. She was nasty. She was well watched because her den wasn't far from some of the roads that were used by everybody that used that area, and game watchers also watched her. I'm thinking that particular year she would have had 1 year old cubs. They weren't with her then, but she would have had 1 year old cubs because she cubbed the year before. It had young cubs the year before. And then typically she typically had cubs every other year. And, the year in between she would have yearlings with her, if they were with her. Because sometimes the yearlings wander off on their own.
Well, typical bear behavior, I'm not comfortable with it. There's situations where you can come across them, they'll bluff charge you, they'll do different things. But as far as a camp setting, when you do a camp setting, if you're not right on top of their den, they will come and check you out, circle your camp two or three times, and they'll grunt and huff and things like that the whole time they're
right.
circling your camp. So a sneak attack from a bear, once you've established it, is very rare. Out in the open,
typically,
out in the wild, and everything
else.
Typically,
run into her when we would be hiking or driving along the rims of that particular canyon, driving on the road, that kind of places where we would encounter. Because we didn't usually camp in or on the rim of that canyon. We camped several miles away. And it was partly because of the bear. Also, it was just nicer, the areas that we chose to camp. I was never comfortable camping in the canyon itself. For those who are not familiar with Arizona's geography and whatnot, canyons have water in the bottom of them. They're the path of water. And flash floods are also quite common, and the rain may have been 50 miles, 100 miles away, however far. You may not have even realized it rained there, and all of a sudden this wall of water is cutting down this canyon. I never, ever camp in the bottom of a canyon. I don't care how wide it is. I'm just never been comfortable doing that. So I don't want to get caught by a wall of water. I've seen them come through, and it's like hearing a freight train coming, and you're running for your life, literally. And I've stood in the bottom of canyons and looked up 75 to 100 feet up the canyon and seen a log jam up further in the canyon wall and known that that is a particular jam that they recovered hikers' bodies from. You may be familiar with that canyon, JC. It was the Chevelon Canyon.
Yeah, Chevelon.
Yeah. So, canyons are not a good place to go camping. She happened to have her den high on the canyon wall, and we just didn't camp in that area. We'd hike there, we'd go play in the water there because the stream ran year round, but we didn't ever camp down there. Nothing longer than a picnic and fooling around in the water.
Yeah, you don't want to spend the night there. You never know what's coming. And that's, monsoon season in Arizona is very unpredictable. We've had at times, I think we lost 12 people, it's a lot longer than that, but Antelope Canyon up by Page, they were in Antelope Canyon.
Yeah, now you can't go in that canyon without a guide.
Yeah.
And it's because of those deaths.
Yeah. You could get a flash flood 50 miles away, and by the time the water gets to you, clear blue sky. That's what the monsoons do. I remember one time, Clear Creek, outside of Winslow, I would take a canoe or whatever and get into the very, very back canyon where most boats couldn't go, and that's where I'd find the best trout fishing in some of those deep pools. And sometimes we would drag a boat up through some shallow waters, rolling down rocks and drop into pools and fish that way. And I was back there one day with my canoe, and I think I had an aid horse at the time on the back of it. And it was raining off and on, sporadically. It wasn't a complete monsoon pattern. And I had this top on it that I'd fashioned and put together out of a tent frame to cover me from these drizzles and things like that. And I was back there fishing. I heard the freight train coming. And there's 100-foot-high-plus canyon walls back there in Clear Creek. And when I heard the freight train, I fired the outboard up, got down on my knees, grabbed the tiller, and hauled butt out of that back canyon. just ahead of this freight train wall of water coming through the canyon. And I got to the popular area, I'm sure you're familiar with it very much, where people party and picnic out at McHood Park there. Uh-huh. And I come flying out. I'm going, there's a wall of water coming. Get these kids out. Come on, get out of here now. And there's little kids bobbing in the water and everything. And they're looking at me all funny. And I'm like, get out of the water now. There's a wall of water coming. And they saw me drag my boat up probably 80 feet as high as I could drag it up. They saw me tear down my tent. They saw me tear down the shade I had. They saw me packing my stuff and getting it up higher. And one by one, as they were watching me, they started getting out of the water. Maybe this guy's not crazy. You know, look at him. He's trying to protect his property from something coming down. And everybody cleared the water, and sure enough, I beat this thing by about maybe 10 minutes. And then it came out of the back canyon. It did spread out, but we had about 12-foot waves come through. And it lapped over those rocks where people sit and picnic.
Uh-huh.
But just watching the crazy man tearing his camp up and throwing everything up as high as he could get it was enough for them to go, there's probably something to what he's saying.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, anybody who lives in that area should at least have the common sense to realize that those walls of water happen. I mean, for one thing, many people have attended the funeral or known somebody who participated in the body recovery, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, that's not something to, you know, scoff at. You know, and another thing that a lot of people don't think about is the lightning. And somebody, at least one person every year in Arizona, probably about the same number in New Mexico, is killed every year while hiking by lightning.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, because so often, especially, you know, when you get on these flat areas, you're the highest thing for miles around. I mean, I can remember we were hiking in a sort of Badlands kind of area. We see the monsoon storms coming in. We're about probably an hour's hard walk, fast walk, back to the Jeep. And unfortunately, the shortest route also involves slogging through sand. Anybody who's slogged through miles and miles of beach without any water knows exactly what I'm talking about. It's hard walking, and especially at a run pace trying to beat the storm, because they do move in incredibly quickly. And wanting to get out of there before the lightning came, I didn't want to become another statistic.
I remember another time, you being familiar with Lake Mary, I had a place across Lake Mary that I had an open area kind of, and then some nice trees and so forth, and I would go and sit up there for a few days and go pike fishing, and I would just go troll with my canoe, and I'd gotten a terrible weather report because I heard sunny skies and in the 70s and so forth. And I was off by the dam fishing, and two lightning bolts hit the dam at the same time. I'm like, oh, my, I better get out of here. And this wall of voodoo rolled in, and I got back to my campsite, and I pulled my canoe up, which just started, the sky opened.
Mm-hmm.
And I pulled my canoe up to shore, and I go, you know, this is going to flood. So I pulled my canoe up to shore, threw the anchor out as far as I could on land. And it rained that whole first night. I had to wade out to where I put that anchor and then pull the boat in. The water rose about 12 feet overnight. The next, and I was still trapped there. I'm like, dang, I'm not crossing this water with all the lightning and everything going on. I had to cross Lake Mary, and I'm not going to. Like, I'm going to stay back here. Stay back here in the trees. Had a lightning strike, hit a tree behind me, go through the ground, hit my metal cot, and knock me off it.
Oh, lovely.
That was special.
Yeah. You know, that's another thing. You know, when you're camping, and anytime you're researching in these areas, I know that that's the most efficient way. The trees become essentially lightning rods. Not only the dead ones that are standing, but live trees. And lightning strikes can do some amazing things. I can remember, lost my hearing for most of the day. We were traveling in a Jeep. We'd just been to the north rim of the Grand Canyon. And lightning struck a tree just as we were driving past it. It was about 30, 40 feet off the road. That tree literally exploded. I mean, toothpicks were flying as far out as we were onto the road. The most incredible noise I had ever heard. And that was the last noise I heard for a number of hours. It took a long time for my hearing to come back after that. I mean, it really hurt. And that tree literally exploded. I mean, you wouldn't have wanted to have been in a tent anywhere near that tree.
It's rough out there. Definitely.
Yeah. Now, when you're out doing research, have you ever gotten caught by storms, or are you really careful about paying attention to the weather reports?
A lot of things I really can't control, especially doing a 2 or 3 day river run on the San Juan. Once you put in and you wave goodbye, you're a day or two from being picked up at the other end. So you're stuck. Whatever weather happens before you get off at the other end, you're stuck with it. So, yeah, it happens.
Uh-huh.
I remember I took this group down in November, and I didn't want to, but I told them, come hell or high water, we'll go down. It was like November 6th. And we were actually the low 60s, but we had some storms moving in and out and so forth. In this particular section of the river, these guys were skilled kayakers and so forth. I made them wear helmets. And they were kind of like, making us wear a helmet. I remember the last 10 miles before we got to Montezuma Creek, a wall of voodoo rolled up and it was dropping golf ball-sized hail on us. And all I could do is hunker down and try to grab some shore and wait it out. And they were happy about those kayaking helmets after the golf ball-sized hail.
even your body getting pelted by that, that golf ball-sized hail hurts.
Very unpleasant.
Yeah. You would know when you got hit by one of those.
The good thing about a kayak is you're half dry all the time. Your bottom half is under a neoprene skirt. So all you got to do to keep dry is your top half. So you're not completely being...
Actually, the kayaks typically used here on the coast are more what you call a sit-on-top style. They're more open. And they don't keep you dry. You tend to be wet all over.
It's good to stay half dry, especially when it's cold. When you got cold weather, things like that.
I'm not sure what the difference is. I'm not a kayaker. I've got some friends who are. My daughter likes it, but and they take these out into the Gulf of Mexico too. They'll take them out as far as some of these barrier islands, 6-8 miles from shore. And they're pretty open kayak. They're not in a skirt like the ones I'd seen before we moved here. So yeah, the kayaks apparently vary by region, I guess.
I think if I had some warm Gulf breezes all the time, I wouldn't have a problem with a sit on top.
Well, they're going out when it's not, by Gulf standards anyhow, warm. I have to spend most of my life in northern Arizona and whatnot, and a lot of time in the Four Corners region. The cold that's here is pretty miserable. Even, that typical windy, dry, lazy wind that cuts right through you because it's too lazy to go around you. When it's 20 degrees and whatnot, it's not as cold as it is here if it's 20 degrees and windy.
Yeah.
It's awful here at 20 degrees and windy. I guess it's the humidity. That damp cold just, you freeze.
Goes right through you.
Mm-hmm. And you just feel soggy all the time. I've been out camping here when it gets down in the teens. And, I'm perfectly comfortable. I'm probably happier camping at 17 degrees than I am at camping at 100 degrees. You can put on more clothes. There's a limit to how much you want to take off, especially when you're on the far side of 40. But the the cold weather, you know, I'm really good. The years of camping in the mountains made me kind of well adapted to dealing with cold weather camping. I'd rather have snow falling on me than rain, to be honest. Snow's warm.
That's why you got to really pick your gear out right. If you're going to end up with a chunk of snow on top of your roof, is going to cave in, break your poles, and smash your face. You're going to have a tent that's going to
your dome tents and your A-frame tents are pretty good at shedding snow.
Some of the camps we had out at Blue Ridge, we would be out there for 9 or 12 days or longer at a time. We'd have people coming and going the whole time. You know, we'd have somebody coming in, somebody coming out, you know, occupy a camp like that. And you've got to take into account, you know, snow load, monsoon, what's going to happen with this, what's going to happen with that.
Right. Right. Now, you know, as far as you're doing your research, does foul weather affect trying to look for things like Bigfoot? Or I know recently you've been looking for a lizard. Really large lizard, it sounds like. You said 2 to 3 feet?
This is just something that's probably native to the area. It just hasn't been brought in yet. We've got 100 years of legend with the Caucasian population and the Navajo population out here talking about these lizards. They mistakenly call them mountain boomers, which there are mountain boomers out here. It's a lizard. It is a species that is recognized. This is something else. This is something different that science has not addressed yet, that we don't have pictures of yet. It's something that needs to be discovered. It's a vicious rascal, and we need to go harvest a couple of them and bring them in.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I've seen, you know, some strange lizards I've never identified, and, you know, I knew the usual species, like the blue-collared lizard, it's very pretty, it's very common, but I have seen a lizard that I would put at probably 12 to 18 inches and ran upright on two legs when it would be running, you know, away from you and whatnot. What it ate, I have no idea. I didn't, you know, all I ever saw it doing was running away from me. I don't, you know, the descriptions that were on your videos and whatnot were of a lizard that had some sort of a frilled collar-like or
hood. Yeah, a shroud, some type of shroud.
Yeah.
Primarily bipedal, too. It locomotes around on two legs, probably 99% of the time. You might find it sunning on a rock or something, and it would be down on all fours. I was talking with Leonard Dan, Chief Dan, here last week, and he was out by Upper Fruitland just walking some areas, and he'd been chased by one before, and it was not a, you know, it was not a pleasant experience that he was, you know, being chased by one. And he saw one sunning itself on a rock, and when it started posturing, and it was on all fours, laying down, sunning itself, when he saw it posturing, he had a .22 with him. He's like, I'm not getting chased by this thing again. So he shot it.
Uh-huh.
But he was talking about how the collar comes out, and you'll have differentiating colors of purple and pink and blue and red all through the collar, you know, like a plethora of different colors. You know, it's not one set of colors. It's like the blood is pumping through in a chameleon kind of way, changing the colors in this shroud, is what he was explaining to me. After he shot this thing, it just turned gray. When the blood stopped pumping, there weren't no more colors to it. And he left it there. This was some years ago. It was just another weird thing. He's out for a walk, probably going to shoot some rabbits, and thinking, I don't want this thing chasing me. I'm just going to whack it now. And he did. But he wasn't thinking it was something of interest to cryptozoology all those years ago. He just decided to whack it.
It was annoying and keep it from getting
back. He didn't want to experience being chased again. So he just cut it to the chase.
And I guess you're also looking for giant snakes.
Giant snakes, and another thing, too, We're going to really hammer on here shortly. We've got some very large, and I hate to say the word lizards, because when I say relic reptile or dinosaur, people just get all weird on me. But we've got something, at least what we've tracked through Red Valley with Chief Dan Leonard down, something in the 1,600-pound variety that leaves a three-toed print very similar to what we find in fossilized dinosaur prints in the area. Fresh.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I saw those prints when you guys were in one of your videos. Yeah.
That, I'm really interested in that. And my son was with me at one time during one of his breaks. He's a ranger sniper for the military, and he's been to Afghanistan and Iraq. And he saw something of a 12 to 14 foot variety, probably 3 feet tall at the shoulders. And he said it looked like a Komodo dragon. And it wasn't a lizard hide. He said it was more like a rhino-esque thing. And it was following us. My spidey senses told me we're being followed. And it was in December. My son wanted to go to some of these research areas. We're snowed out on the mountains. It's cold. I thought it would drop down into what we call Skinwalker Wash out there by Red Valley and get out of the wind. And it worked out pretty good. We wanted to have a cigarette, and I saw this rock face had fallen off. It's probably 60 foot tall by 100 feet long. And I went and looked behind it. We had about 3 or 4 feet of room to get in behind this rock face. So we went back there, and we're talking, having a cigarette. And we're done, and I said, if we've been being followed, whatever it is going to be watching this rock, wondering where we went. It knows we came in here, but it's going to expose itself because it's going to be out there watching this rock, wondering where we are. And I jumped out right, he jumped out left, and he tried to get a binocular up on it. He really didn't even need a binocular, and it ran down the side of the hill, and we did a horseshoe perimeter, and where we meet up, we walk around this knoll and meet up in a horseshoe. It made its way through the sand and then hit the red rocks and disappeared. But a Komodo dragon with a rhino hide.
I don't know. I've never encountered anything like that out there, and I'm probably glad I never did. You know, the fact that I used to spend so much time with just me alone, or me with kids, or me with just a dog, out hiking and camping and whatnot, you know, an encounter with something like that, I mean, no wonder my family and friends were concerned about my solitary habits.
Well, you know, it was probably the good Lord looking out for you, definitely.
Yep, they say fools and children, right? Yeah, I was long past childhood, so. Yeah, I did. I spent a lot of time doing that stuff on my own, mostly because I enjoy it. And, you know, as anybody who has been single for a long time knows, you go to make plans and other people are going to go with you to do it. They always back out at the last minute. So it's like either I can just stay home too, or I can go ahead and go do what I wanted to do to begin with. So I would go do what I wanted to do to begin with.
But, you know, over the years, and looking back over the years too, 95% of the time I've been by myself.
Yeah, you know, I mean, you know.
And it comes down to plans, it comes down to this, that, and otherwise. 95% of the time I've been out there all by my lonesome.
Yeah, so, you know, I have to admit, Greg, my husband is very content to be dragged along on whatever adventure I come up with these days. And, you know, we've been out in northern Florida, and, you know, we've had some stuff that was questionable. Did we ever sight anything? No. Did we ever have concrete proof? No. One time I did find hair caught in branches at what would be just above shoulder height for me, and it wasn't a horse trail. There was no sign of bear. It wasn't horse hair either. I know what horse hair looks like. It wasn't human hair. It was dark reddish, burnt to, and black hairs. And they weren't what you'd call curly or straight. It was coarser than human hair, though. But much much less coarse than, say, a horse's mane or tail.
How far are you from the panhandle?
Oh, a couple hours, I guess. We were on
the panhandle. I'm trying to get down there next month.
Swamp Thing.
Swamp Things down there.
Swamp Things happens to be the name of our poach.
Oh, really?
Swamp Thing. Yeah,
well, it has a I'll just go find your poach. I found Swamp Thing.
Yeah, yeah. Swamp Thing is what the boat was called, has been named. Yeah, it's kind of kiddywampus. It's an old aluminum flat bottom boat, a 16-foot fishing boat with a 25-horsepower motor that was built the year I graduated from high school. Oh, my God. Yeah. And, you know, it's fine and dandy for two people to do a little bit of fishing. Would I take it out to the Barrier Islands? Not unless somebody gave me some really good trucks that made me really stupid.
Well, this,
no, I
would. This Swamp Thing has a, it's not toes. It's got a three-clawed print. And it's not a gator. It's bipedal. It doesn't leave a trail drag. I mean, a tail drag.
Uh-huh.
And it kills people.
Okay, now I've not heard of this particular thing. I've heard of all sorts of things. Now, the area that we like to haunt in Florida, in the Panhandle, is along a creek, and it's forested. I've never seen swamp there. I've seen, you know, some steep places where a seep spring exists, but I've never seen any kind of swamp there. There's no gators in the water. It's too cold and too fast flowing, which is why I like it. I regard gators as like sea monsters. You know, you can't see them, and they're scary, and you don't know what they do. Gators, you know, for somebody who's lived in the desert most of their life, gators are just, they don't make sense. They're scary. So, yeah. I have to admit, I'm not real crazy about dealing with gators, so I like to go to places where it's known that gators don't exist. There's also very few snakes, especially in the water there, again, because of the colder temperature and the speed of the current. So I feel comfortable going and playing in that water. Yeah. You know,
It's not a pleasant thing paddling along in a canoe, and 2 feet away from you, a gator jumps out of the water and grabs a bird off a branch. It's just not a pleasant, settling situation.
Yeah, you know, recently I was talking about the joys of being a woman on an all-day fishing trip, and the inevitable call of nature comes. And everybody says, well, just, you know, sit on the edge of the boat and do your thing. And, okay, that's a balancing trick on a small boat. You know, I'm talking 16-foot, you know, maybe 4-foot wide. You don't feel real stable doing that. In addition, I have this really wild imagination. I know how high they put the bait when they're trying to catch gators. And so I know how high out of the water they can jump. And we're often fishing in brackish or actually salt water. We may be far enough out. Well, sharks are known to go clear up to Illinois up the Mississippi River. So bull sharks can be in brackish or even fresh water. So, you know, I've got the choice. So, you know, I can start envisioning sharks or I can start envisioning gators. And my wild imagination, oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't drink much on the days we go out fishing. Yeah, so...
Everything that's in the water, you're not going to catch me swimming unintentionally ever. Not going to happen. I might get dumped out of my boat. I might have a rapid just kick my ass and push me out of my boat or get me sucked out of my boat. But to swim intentionally in any of the waters in this area, forget it. Especially down south. When you know you've got water snakes, when you know you've got alligators, for fact, you know, you're not going to catch me out of a boat device. It's not going to happen.
Yeah, you know, in addition, I've had an injury that left me with one arm that doesn't do much. And I hadn't been swimming, and I went swimming with my family last year and discovered that even though I wasn't crazy about the water, I was a good swimmer. I could swim a long ways. I was a persistent swimmer, not really a strong one, but a persistent one. So I could swim a long ways even with strong currents. And then I discovered I can't even tread water, let alone swim. So the first thing I did was I went and bought this fancy life jacket. No more of that orange over the neck, old-fashioned thing that was cheap but efficient. No, I wanted one that I knew darn well was going to keep me afloat because with somewhat, you know, I guess maybe I'm not that uncommon. For somebody who's come from a very arid environment, I'm really suspicious of water. So there's some fear there. I don't like to get in unknown water and over my head and unknown currents and whatnot. Yeah, it was time for this fancy life jacket. So now I have a fancy life jacket. Anytime I'm near the water, I will be wearing it because there again, discovering I couldn't swim at all sort of increased the fear of water.
Let's go back to McHood Park outside of Winslow.
Oh, yeah, Clear Creek Reservoir.
Yeah. And a young man who was supposedly had drowned, but actually he was grabbed by a merman. I remember that story you were telling me.
Yeah, he said a woman, I think.
A mermaid.
It was a boy, a young boy. I'm thinking probably between 4 and 8 years old. And when he was pulled out of the water, he told his family that the lady had grabbed him and tried to keep him. Now, there's a number of stories that are told about that particular body of water, which I know you're familiar with. You've been fishing on it many occasions. And in addition, that area, that reservoir has drownings pretty regular. I'll admit that the area south of the bridge, the water's very, very deep. The canyon walls are pretty sheer. There's rock ledges that are fun to sit on and sun yourself and fish and whatnot. And I used to go there and go swimming, go fishing, let my daughter, 5, 6, 7 years old, swim there, and so forth and so on. Didn't think anything of it until the night I spent the night there. And did I see anything? No. Did I have some really weird feelings? Yes. To be honest, we never, ever, ever went swimming there again. In fact, I rarely went there again, not even for fishing in the daytime, and never at night.
That's an area, too, where I've got the giant snake petroglyphs from probably 800 or 900 A.D., in those canyons where they've had it's a perennial flow going into this canyon, so it'd be a pretty obvious thing that, you know, if you had a water snake to the area, and they're depicting this giant snake because you've got the elk, the antelope, you've got the people and the little stick people and the things that they're drawing, and then you've got this big snake that they're drawing too. Yeah, they're telling
the
story.
I had Hopi friends who were telling me, and I don't remember the entire story, so don't take this as gospel, but there is a white feathered serpent that lives there. And I can't remember if it was men that weren't supposed to swim there or women, but one or the other wasn't supposed to swim there. And that periodic serpent would be sighted. And I know that people about once a year would you'd hear a story about somebody saw it. Most people would put it off to, you know, they were smoking something or they were drinking too much of something and, you know, that's what caused them to see it. But that the serpent would claim victims, and that's where the drowning victims were being claimed, was the reason for the drownings in this particular area. You know, I don't know. You know, it's an interesting story. You know, there's... The explanation I was given for the number of drownings is there's peculiar currents underneath because of springs and so forth and so on. I don't know. I know that I just didn't think it was a good idea after the night we spent on those rock ledges. We never went swimming except on the designated swimming area in McCoy Park itself.
You know, I put a story up that Mike Smith wrote some years ago in Mysterious New Mexico, talking about a blue feathered serpent out in this area, out here.
Uh-huh.
So the feathered serpent is a continuing denominator that comes up.
Right. And, you know, it kind of makes you wonder. I'm always of the mind that legends are often have a kernel of truth in them. And now we know that many dinosaurs were feathered.
Yep.
You know, so were there dinosaur relics that carried on at least into the fair recent past, maybe, you know, 1,000 or 5,000 years ago, for the stories to still exist in some sort of a form? You know, that's kind of a pretty good question, you know. Did they still exist? And is that where the stories come from, or do they still exist yet?
They still exist yet, I guarantee you. Something of that nature. I don't think we have a full-size T-Rex running around tearing up houses. We've got many dinos, many T-Rexes. We've got things that in an iguana type situation that are 2 or 3 feet tall at the shoulder that are very vicious. We've got a lot out here that need to be brought in for science.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, you can't help but compare these old stories with the possibility that these things still exist. And there has to be something for the story. I mean, it wasn't that they were sitting around drinking too much beer and that's what they came up with. These stories are too widespread.
No, and going back to the collared lizard that we're going to go out and pursue, I've got 100 square miles of sightings of different sizes. I've got 100 years of sightings in the area. So, I mean, we've got something to work on. Obviously, there's a breeding population. It's not just one lizard. It's not a repatriated pet. It's something unique to the area. And I think the snake, if we get the opportunity to bring these snakes in or however we do it, is going to be something unique to the area also.
Yeah, it'd be interesting. I know that on the one video you showed a place that appeared to be a snake trail that was coming up out of the river. That snake trail looked like it was probably 18 inches across. That's fat snake.
Them some big snakes. And that's the thing, is they're using the water when it's very, very cold and frigid, and obviously probably when it's warm also. A rattlesnake isn't even up at this time. And we've got something crossing the water, using the water, getting up onto different land sections when it's very frigid, very cold, where a typical reptile would not enjoy those water temperatures.
Yeah. Well, hang on to that thought right there, JC. Folks, the first half of the Dawn of Shades has come to an end, and it's time for our break. While we're gone, check out our website at www.exogenynetwork.com. You can click on the guests under the J section for JC Johnson, and there's some videos right there that will take you to YouTube so you can see some of the things that we're talking about as well as look at other videos about it. And go ahead and send me an email. Tell me what you think. We will be back in just a few minutes with more about our topic.
Hi, this is Rob Simone, and I want to tell you about my brand new show here on the Paranormal Radio Network. Each week, I bring you the most interesting people on the planet, the most in-depth discussions, and the most controversial issues. We'll go where no talk show dares to go. Join me every week for the Rob Simone Talk Show here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
Hello, everyone. Trish Sheridan, host of A Global Focus. Come join us each Friday evening at A Global Focus's new time, 6 p.m. Eastern. Come join the discussion.
Hey, hi there. Got your attention? I'm Gia Scott, and I was curious what you were doing from 7 to 9 p.m. Central Time on Tuesdays. See, I host this really interesting little radio program that airs live then, and we bring in all sorts of guests. Authors, experiencers, and everything in between. It's paranormal and guaranteed to make you go, My guest list is always up at www.giascott.com, and do tune in to the Dawn of Shades from 7 to 9 p.m. on Tuesdays.
Hello, I'm Chip.
I'm Nicole.
Together we host the Mind Cemetery, where the paranoia about the paranormal comes to rest.
We broadcast live every Monday night at 11 p.m. Eastern for 2 full hours. You can find us on Twitter and Facebook, as well as our website, mindcemetery.com.
We cover all the topics you won't hear on your local news.
Well, I don't really like watching the news anyway.
Then this is the perfect show for someone like you.
I wouldn't go that far. After all, I am the skeptic.
So you don't believe in ghosts?
Nope.
UFOs?
Yeah, no.
How about Bigfoot?
Not really. You'll never find a Bigfoot.
How about the lost city of Atlantis, then?
Isn't that on Google Earth? No? Then forget it. It's never going to get...
Looks like I have my work cut out for me, then, as I take on a true skeptic as we discuss the latest and hottest topics in the UFO and paranormal fields with some of the most provocative and informative guests to hit the airwaves.
That's right, you do. And it all happens right here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network, live every Monday night at 11 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook, as well as mindcemetery.com.
Tune in to UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Hi, I'm psychic medium Chris George.
And I'm Stephanie Benetti. Sure about that, Chris? It's more like psychic extra large.
Yeah, real funny, Benetti. The Benetti again being my girlfriend, you would know. Together, we are Second Sight NYC, a parapsychic radio show based out of New York City.
Join us each week as we journey into the unknown. Let's cross the threshold of reality together.
We take a fun and no-nonsense approach to our show, and we love to interact with our audience. Each week, you can expect a great guest, interesting topics, and strong opinions by myself and Stephanie.
As well as rapid readings, psychic dream interpretations, and the gemstone of the week. And don't ask us a question that you don't want an answer to.
Give us 2 hours of your time to inform, enlighten, and entertain you. Let the journey begin.
Join us.
Light up your night with The Kevin Smith Show. Hi, this is Kevin Smith. Join me Monday through Friday right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Welcome back to the Dawn of Shades. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and tonight I'm having a great conversation with J.C. Johnson, and we are going to be joined later in the program by Brenda Harris, who was along on one of the trips when they recorded some Bigfoot vocalizations. You know, when people talk about the strange things that they've heard in the forest, or I'm more likely to hear about how people are going to go camping in the wilderness for some peace and quiet. And when we were talking on break, we were talking about some of the noises that you hear in the woods at night. Would you categorize a wilderness night as being peaceful and quiet, J.C.?
Not necessarily, no. I wouldn't at all. If you're listening, if you have to listen, it's not quiet at all. Now, sometimes you could, there's places where in a canyon, some outfits I've been into, absolute peace and quiet. I like that. I really do.
Uh-huh.
That's where I'm at. And I'm not trying to discern what's going on. I'm enjoying my peace and quiet and my serenity.
Yeah, the peace and quiet and serenity is sometimes a little hard to get. Now, I will admit I'm no expert on the southeastern USA's woods and forests and so forth and so on. I've only been frequenting this area for, I think, 9 years now, something like that. And that's, you know, compared to a lifetime in the southwestern region, that's not very much time. But, you know, when I'm sitting in the woods, I know that the night sounds, especially between midnight and dawn, can be incredibly loud. Insects, the birds, the small animals, the things that hunt and haunt the night, there's a lot of racket going on. It gets much quieter about 30 minutes after sundown, after the birds and everybody that's on the day shift has gone to do their thing, and the night shift has settled down. It gets pretty quiet compared to the night. Those pre-dawn hours can be really loud. Even the sounds of crickets and cicadas and everything else, it can be loud. Even the buzz of mosquitoes and gnats, it becomes this overall loud racket.
The blast about the Four Corners area, especially you get above 5,000 or 6,000 feet, about all you're going to hear naturally is crickets, and you're not going to hear many crickets if you don't have much water. You have the opportunity to have some complete silence. If there's no water, you could have
right.
a really quiet time and really discern what you're listening to and pick apart what you're listening to. And if it's later in the season and the crickets have gone to bed, then you'll have an even better opportunity to listen to what's going on at the nighttime.
Yeah, I have to remember, admit, my memory, I think, say the 7,000 to 9,000 foot range, probably. You're still in the forest, and especially in the fall and winter when, you know, being out there and the snow would come down. When it snows, it's as though it becomes really quiet. And that would be like, wow, this is really cool. There's, you know, you can hear a branch fall a mile away. And they will because of the weight of the snow. Because the snow is going to be soggy wet.
Or you can hear a Sasquatch rip a tree in half, a dead tree. That's always special.
Yeah, well,
yeah, I love that. I do.
You know, as long as it's not too close, it probably would be interesting. You know, and maybe it's you know, the feminine side of me, but I have to admit, large, hairy hominids with unknown responses to human activity can be a little bit intimidating.
Well, we go to a migration route, and I'm going back to your knowledge of the area. We go back to Clear Creek in Winslow, and Clear Creek comes from Blue Ridge proper, and we've got our local lore and legend of the Blue Ridge Banshee, but they were working their way down Clear Creek proper onto the Little Colorado and either going north or south, and you've got the Little Colorado in Winslow, And then it went north or south at different times of the year on the Little Colorado River. And incredible, huge track finds. Big, huge track finds there. And I'll get to that later, but I mean, miles of tracks, miles, walking down the semi-arid, semi-wet riverbed at different times of the year. We could just walk out there in this wonderful mud back many years
ago. Don't forget the quicksand, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, don't forget the quicksand. You've got that on the San Juan also. Got to be very careful. And you've got mud that sucks you up to your thighs real quick, too, on the San Juan.
Yeah, quicksand doesn't look like the movies, folks. If you've never experienced it, you don't want to. But the harder you struggle, the harder it sucks you down. Yeah, it's not fun. I think the deepest I've ever been in is hip deep.
Logging cattle go down, and especially on the San Juan, several times during a year, we're going to run across cattle, and at times they've tried to tie ropes onto them and pull them out and rescue them, and occasionally they live. Sometimes they go lay down and they die. They've been in the water for so long, and then the quicksand. It's unfortunate, but they come down to drink and they get sucked into this quicksand. Not a pleasant thing.
No. Everybody thinks of horses as always being sure-footed, etc., but no, they're not. They will make mistakes, too.
I remember the Hacienda River near Wickenburg had some of the sneakiest quicksand. San Juan quicksand, if you're in the sand, you could be sucked up real quick. On the Hacienda, a sure-footed horse would step right into this quicksand and just disappear.
Wow.
Different kind of quicksand. And now, you know, north of Phoenix, about, what, an hour? North of Phoenix.
Like
probably less now as Phoenix has been expanding. But the Hacienda was a different type of river, different type of quicksand than we have up here.
Yeah, essentially, for people who are unfamiliar with quicksand, quicksand is sand that has somehow become suspended in the water mixture. And when you look at it, it looks like solid sand or just wet sand. If you tap it, like with your finger or with your walking stick or whatnot, it'll quiver. And that's kind of a clue. It'll quiver like Jell-O or something, you know, and it's like, oh, you know, poke that a little and see how firm it really is. Sometimes it's shallow. It can be no more than an inch or so deep. Sometimes it's very, you know, huge deep pockets. And those huge deep ones are really, really dangerous.
The Hacienda could have suspended mica, which is fool's gold and so forth, suspending and floating the sand, and you could step into a 30-foot deep pool and disappear.
Right, yeah. It's not fun. Yeah, my last encounter was just a couple of years ago, and I was walking in a creek bed, and I thought it was solid sand. The dog was walking beside me. Now, the dog with her larger webbed feet and lower body mass didn't sink into the quicksand. Now, my husband was just maybe 20 yards away from me. When I stepped into it, I was up to my hips and nothing flat. But there's one advantage to a good dog that's well-trained. She'd been taught long, long ago that when I grabbed her tail and told her to pull me out of whatever I was in, you know, up a hill, down a hill, out of the water, into the water, across the water, whatever, I can just grab her tail and she will pull. And since I couldn't reach the brush on the bank and I wasn't carrying a walking stick, she was my best bet. She actually saw it, got myself wiggled out even before my husband got down to the creek bed where I was at. And, you know, there again, no sign of it. I had walked in that creek bed down there before, but I may not have gone that far. And in talking with some people that had the familiarity with that particular area. They said there used to be a deep pool that they went swimming in that particular spot. And it filled in several years ago during one of the hurricanes when it flooded in that area. That's how that pocket of quicksand was created. And I guess the pool used to be probably 6 to 12 feet deep in that area. So, yeah, it apparently was deeper than it looked, and I was hit deep in almost instantly.
By the way, you can keep all of your hurricanes. They're yours.
I have to admit, I leave when they're coming. I've never experienced the full brunt of a hurricane. I lived in New Orleans for Katrina, but I spent it in northeastern Texas. So I have never experienced the full force of a hurricane, not even a Category 1. I've been on the fringe of it, because sometimes, like, I'd be in Mississippi, hit Louisiana, you catch the fringe of it, or I would be in Louisiana, it was hitting Panhandle or Mississippi, and you just got the fringe of it. But I've never experienced a full brunt, and I don't know if I'll ever stay for one. I'm a big chicken.
Well, that was something that would occasionally come up into the Flagstaff area, is the leftovers of a hurricane from the Gulf.
Right.
You know, on occasion that would happen. And that's when I couldn't really read the weather, like I've always read the weather, and I'm like, I know this, I know that, I can see this cloud bank coming in. When we had leftover chunks of hurricanes cruising up through that area, I was at wit's end. I couldn't read nothing.
No, it's entirely a different weather pattern. For one thing, they're coming in from the Gulf, and they're sort of making a U as they swept through Mexico and then up through southern New Mexico and Arizona. And I know they've gone as far north as Utah, even. Because I remember one year it flooded up there as a result of a storm that was originally part of a hurricane. So it's a different pattern, because usually the weather is all moving from west to east, by and large. And this is, you know, sort of a south to north with a swing or something. I don't know. But it is. It's an entirely different weather pattern. I was living in central Arizona when I remember the last hurricane that came through, or remnants of a hurricane that came through. Yeah, the weather can be quite interesting. You know, as far as how the weather affects your research, now, do you do much research during the winter?
One of the strangest things we came across, I was riding with Leonard then. We were going up to Sunnyside Meats in Colorado, and he was helping me. It's a slaughterhouse, but it's much more than that. It's a green thing. It's a good thing. It's an area where we can help the ranchers promote their local product, their locally raised, hormone-free, GMO-free beef and pork and poultry and sheep and things like that. It's something completely natural.
Mm-hmm.
And he was coming up there to help me. I'd left the employment there, but they needed some help. We're on our way back. We're going by Hogback, which is out on the reservation, heading in toward Farmington. And I was telling Leonard, I saw something standing on that second ledge, clear as day, holding a club, or something that looked like a club, in its hand. And as I was telling him that, we looked off to the right, and right around that corner was something in the water. And the two young ones were standing, and I shouldn't say young ones, the two different things than this was, were standing on the sandbar. And him and I both saw at the same time. I saw the little linebackers on the sandbar. Leonard saw the little linebackers on the sandbar and the one in the water. And we went up and we turned around immediately and came back. And the two ones that were on the sandbar jumped off into the bushes. The one that was in the water fishing kept fishing. And I ran forward taking photos. this morning was 8 degrees, and the water is just above freezing. You've got ice below and ice chunks floating through, and it's a miserable day.
Uh-huh.
And we've got somebody standing almost up to his thighs in the water, waiting for something to come nibble on his stinky fur and slap a fish up onto the shore. So as far as weather affecting the situation that day and on days prior to that, no, not a problem.
Mm-hmm. So what is your favorite season to go hunting, you might say?
As far as Sasquatch, right now, I'm taking a break. My favorite hunting is where I can be in some beautiful mountains and sit by a campfire roasting weenies and marshmallows, and they'll come in and make themselves known in one way, shape, or the other. I don't tree knock. I don't rock knock. I don't do any calls. Not for the last 6 years.
Uh-huh.
So my research isn't even research when it comes to the furry ones anymore. And the pinnacle, the precise, wonderful thing, Lord willing, that's going to happen is the DNA study on a global scale with over 106 samples. When that comes out, then we're going to reconfigure and rejoin and decide where do we go from here. But as far as running,
when do you expect the DNA test to be done?
I think we've got some revisions and so forth and everything else. I would say before the summer, in my opinion. And if it takes longer, then so what?
Right,
I'm not doing the work. Dr. Melba Ketchum's doing all the work, and she's suffering the consequences for all the time she's put into this. She had a great successful business, and we hurt her with this.
Uh-huh.
So I hope she recoups 100 times over what she's lost.
Uh-huh. So it wasn't a politically wise choice for her to make to go ahead and do this testing for you guys?
Financially, it was not a wise choice. It was not a wise thing for her to get involved in this. But the deeper she got into it, the more she pursued it. God bless her.
Now, you know, in the preliminary results, which I presume is what's really kind of hurt her, why do you think it hurt her in terms of her business?
Well, what happens here, and we get down to the brass tacks, she got into a fight with a cat club, and they got nasty with her, different things like that. But as far as the perfect science of what she's doing, she's a very good scientist.
Mm-hmm.
And the peer review paper is not just her. She's got lots of other doctors and PhDs involved in this peer-reviewed paper of all these samples. They've been sent out for double-blind testing to other laboratories. Not just her. There's overkill on this, and for good reason. Without having a body to have a reference to fire it up again or whatever, we have all these DNA samples on a global scale. It's a wonderful thing.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see when that comes out and what comes of it, because we all know that science doesn't like unexplained things. They like, you know, concrete evidence all lined up in a row, and new ideas come very slowly to the scientific community sometimes.
Well, that's why science wants to put everything into a box to explain it to you and make it make sense. If they can put a label on it or whatever, that's what they'll do. We've got over 300 bodies in the 9 to 12 foot variety underneath the Smithsonian Institution because it does not play into our human condition and ancestry as they can explain it.
Uh-huh.
If they can't explain it, they cover it up. So when you're dealing with philosophical paleontology, philosophical hominology, philosophical ancestries and things like that, if it doesn't fit into the book that they learn from, they're going to cover it up. And I hope the end of all this will bring out the whole truth of everything and not be covering things up and hiding things that you can't explain.
Right. Now, we did have a question come up in the virtual auditorium, and that was going back to your research with Bigfoot and going out and looking for them. People know whether or not you ever tried to feed them.
Typically, they don't like anything I leave up for them. And they throw rocks at me, so I'm like the Charlie Brown of the Bigfoot world, other than some other people who, you know, they don't take my offerings, and I shouldn't even call it that, you know. They don't.
I know that I've heard other people talk about they leave out things like fruit and so forth and so on, and their offerings would disappear.
Well, you know, I shouldn't entirely
mean that,
say that.
That Bigfoot's taking them, by the way.
We had a situation where John Lee and I put up a game camera, and we put down a bunch of fruit and local things to the area. You know, don't put apples out for a Sasquatch if he doesn't know what an apple is. If it's grown locally, then he'll know what an apple is. Anyway, we put a bunch of fruit out. We're leaving the area. You can see the game cam picture. We're leaving the area. The next
caller is going to be coming on the air, so go ahead and finish your story.
Okay.
Hello?
Hey, Brenda, this is Gia Scott on the Donna Shades radio program.
Hi, how are you?
We're just
fine.
Can
you hear
me? Live and on the, we hear you just fine. You're a little bit scruffy sounding, but hopefully it'll clear up here.
Can you give me a minute? Let me call Tanya. I'm in a building with loud music. I'll be right out. Okay. I can hear you better. Hold on. Okay, sorry about that. Can you hear me now?
Now we can hear you much, much
you
better.
You sound much better, Brenda.
Yes, I got you were with JC on one of the trips when he recorded some of the whoops that were being made by Bigfoot. Now, having heard the same sounds when I was out camping alone with my kids, I sort of wanted to get your perspective on what it's like to listen to this kind of thing when you're out on a trip. Had you gone out on this trip knowing you were looking for Bigfoot, or was it a trip for other reasons and Bigfoot just came along for the ride?
No, actually, that's what we went out there for. That was our my daughter and I, that was our first time going out with JC out to the Gucci guy. And I wanted to see, well, we both did, wanted to see if we'd get any kind of encounters or sound or something. And
when you heard the whoop, you know, how did you feel about it? Did you know that it was Bigfoot when you heard it?
So I wasn't too sure, but it was very loud. Very loud. I've never heard anything like that before. And
did you think it was about to where you were camped?
Well, the first whoop was at 1 o'clock in the morning. And I heard it from the distance coming from the west. And I figured, well, that's got to be him coming. So an hour goes by, about 2 o'clock, because I was watching the time. 2 o'clock rolls around, and I heard another whoop. Now, at the same time, around 2 o'clock, when that whoop went off, I could swear I heard a lady scream really loud. And you know, like I said, it was getting closer. By 2 o'clock, it was a little bit closer. At the same time this thing whooped, I heard a lady scream. Now, the time that we were out there, there was hunters out there. all over.
Uh-huh.
So I think this whoop, where he was coming from the west, was making his way towards Fort Weaver. And I believe where this thing was whooping, I believe maybe there were some campers in that area there. Like I said, I swore I heard a lady scream, and I thought, oh, my gosh, it's coming closer. 3 o'clock rolls around, and boy, was it loud. Like I said, I've never heard anything like that before. And this was probably just right above where we were actually camping, which we were like down in a little valley, and he was just right above on the ledge there, where on top, just right above us.
He was very close, very close.
Yeah. He was. I mean, when he says close, and when my daughter heard that, I kind of nudged her and said, hey, you know how it is. Listen, she goes, I can hear it. And it was so loud that it's almost like our chest was like just vibrating. That's how loud this thing was. Never felt anything like that before at all. It was like, I believe, 3 times right above us.
Uh-huh.
And you could hear something like, you know, walking around. And then all of a sudden, it was just like, wow. You know, it, like I said, it was really, really, really loud. We never heard anything like that before. And,
that was your first trip. Did you ever go on another trip?
That was her first trip up to this location. It's a very, very secret place we've got up on the Lukachukai, where we've had Brenda could talk about some more encounters after that she's had. But it's been a very easy access place where they'll come in and do things with you and to you. I'll let Brenda talk about the whoop some more, but she needs to talk about another time when her and her sister went down into this canyon. That's a really interesting story.
So you continue, it didn't scare you off, Brenda. You continued going on these trips.
Okay. Well, my sister, but anyway, my sister came over one Sunday, or she called me one Sunday afternoon. And at the time, she used to be PD with Ignacio, Colorado. So she's very well armed. She knows all her stuff. And she called me one Sunday morning. She says, "Can you take me up to the mountains? I just need to get away from home, just clear my mind." So I'm like, "Okay, let's go camping." So she picks me up. And this was in, I believe, in October, in 2010.
And keep in mind,
we went up that way.
Keep in mind, we had a crew up there the night before that basically got run out. So Brenda's going back to the scene with her sister. Okay, continue.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. Okay. So the we got up there. By the time we got up there, it was already dark, and it was like 7 o'clock in the evening. So it was dark. And so in that area, when they say dark, it's really dark. So we got in there. I pulled the ride around, right where the campfire usually is, and I got a little too close, and I wanted to get away from there, so I did that. And we got out, and we started getting some wood together. And I put my hand in the ash, right, in the campfire there. And when I put my hand in there, the ashes were still red, and it was still hot. And when I picked up the can, it was pretty warm, and I dropped them. I'm like, holy cow, this is still warm. I'm like, nobody was in here all day. Now, I know there was a couple of guys there the night before, but they swore they put all the fire out and nobody stayed there that night, which happened to be on Saturday night. Nobody stayed there, but Sunday morning, that Sunday evening, my sister and I got up there, and I'm like, wow, wonder why it's still red, Well, anyway, we went ahead and got some wood and stuff, and we were making a lot of noise, and I was, making a lot of noise, picking up twigs and stuff. And we kind of got the fire going a little bit, and we got that pretty soon, probably within about 10 minutes, we got that fire going up really good. And we started, got our chairs out, and we started sitting there. We're just talking a little bit, and it kind of started getting chilly. So all of a sudden, well, during that time, before we sat down, when we were picking up, you know, twigs to get the fire going, sister tells me, she looks at me, she says, hey, did you hear that? I'm like, what are you talking about? What did you hear? She heard something like a big thug. Now, I didn't hear it because I was a little further off and I was making a bunch of noise with, you know, dry wood and you stepping on and you're making noise. And then she heard something drop. And she was just like, what was that? Like a loud thug sound twice, like boom, boom. And I looked at her and I said, I don't know, I didn't hear it because I was way over here and I was making a lot of noise when I was picking up some dry wood. Well, anyway, kept on going, got the fire going up really good. We sat there for a little while. By this time it was about maybe 8:30. And we got chairs out, sat down, talked a little bit, and it started getting a little bit cool. So I went back to the Jeep, and around the back, I went to go get my jacket. Now, when we pulled up, there was no log whatsoever around that area where we parked. Now, when I went back to get my jacket, well, lo and behold, there's a big old log right by the Jeep. That's what she heard was a big old thug. And this thing, we either startled this thing to, you know, maybe it was bringing the wood down to where we were at and didn't see us or saw us and dropped that and left that there for us. And it was a big log. And I was like, wow, that's what the noise was. That's what she heard. Well, we sat there for a while, and she kind of spooked her a little bit. And then we sat there and kept talking. You know, pretty soon it was after 9 o'clock, and we sat and talked for a long time. And pretty soon she started hearing something coming from the west heading towards us. And I just told her, I'll just keep it calm, you know, just keep on talking. And, you know, she was talking about work and stuff. Then pretty soon she started seeing something walking from tree to tree, and she's like, what is that? And I already knew what it was, and I just trying to keep her calm, you know, and she's just like, what, you know, the aspen trees, the trunks are really small, right? And this thing was walking from tree to tree, and she's like, I see something black coming, and it's going from tree to tree, but it's coming closer. I caught up and I started walking to where this thing she was seeing. So I picked the camera and started, you know, taking pictures. Uh-huh. And went back and sat down, told her to come, I don't see anything, I'm still coming. And we kept talking for a while. Pretty soon it was about 10:30. Now by 10:30, this thing was very close to us. And she definitely got a good figure going from tree to tree. She goes, he's standing right there, I can see it. So I went over there, and I looked, like I said, I, you know, tried to keep her calm, and then I thought, went that way again, flashed the camera. As soon as I did that, I got a smell, a really bad odor. And I was like, uh-oh, okay, he's definitely right there. So I told her, I didn't say anything because I wanted to come in just a little bit closer so I can get a good picture and then we can leave. And I told her, I said, come here. I said, come stand right here by me and tell me if, I said, smell it. Can you smell anything? Just a nice breeze flows through and all of a sudden she gets that smell. She totally freaked, and she just, you know, it was like, okay, grab everything and just throw it in the ride real quick. I said, no, just stay. Let's just act like we're, you know, play it normal. But, I mean, she was just throwing stuff in the ride. I'm like, no. And we had that fire going big. I mean, it was bright enough where you could see all the way around us. Well, anyway, got her calmed down finally and putting things in the ride slowly. And then I said, okay, what about the fire? So let's wait until the fire kind of dims down. And it was kind of funny because she's like, no way. And she just started throwing dirt on the fire, finally got that down really good. And I'm like, wow, you're supposed to be a cop. You know, I was just kind of making fun of her at the time. And pretty much got it down really good. And I said, okay, well, let's go. So we get into the ride, and you kind of got to go over this little hump. So I get over there, and I turn to the west, start heading out. Well, when we started heading out, I stepped on the gas. All of a sudden, I could feel a tug underneath the Jeep. And this thing didn't want us to leave because it just jerked the Jeep back. And I gave it gas, and it wouldn't go. I'm like, oh, okay, this thing's kind of got, it's got a good, nice grip on the Jeep in the back. So I gave it some gas again, and it tugged back even more. So I told my sister, I said, look, I'm going to step on the brakes, and I want you to kind of climb back there and look and see if there's anything holding, what's holding the Jeep, because something is holding, doesn't want us to leave. And she was scared, and she just like barely, I hit the brakes, she barely flicked over. She was so scared she didn't want to actually get out and look or climb into the back to look. So I just told her, I said, okay, well, just hold on because I'm going to really step on the gas. So I said, hold on. So, man, I stepped on the gas. It kind of went a little bit, and this thing just jerked back. I mean, it just hung onto the Jeep in the back. It wouldn't even go. I looked at her, and I said, okay, this, he doesn't want us to leave at all. I said, okay, what do we do? I said, well, I'll put it in reverse, and I'm going to slam on the brakes, and maybe it'll hit its head or something, you know. So that's what I did. And put it in drive again. Man, and I really stepped on the gas. It took off. And it went pretty good. And all of a sudden, we felt that tug again. And this time, this thing just held on. And I stepped on the gas, and it was revving up. And my sister here is just freaking out. And I just told her, I said, calm down, we'll get out. And then finally, I really stepped on, and it released. And it, the Jeep just took off. Went down a ways, just a little ways, before we, just before we actually get out of that little canyon there, again, we felt that tug. And once it held on, it just wouldn't give, let go. So I did the same thing, but the night took off, and then we got out of there, and this thing didn't want us to leave. But we made it out of there, and all the way out, you just had that really, just a really bad feeling. Just something is falling. This thing, there was more than one, I can tell you that. The reason why I say that is because there was one running alongside of the Jeep, one on the left and one on the right. And my sister's like, you know, we need to hurry and get out of here because this thing is just running right along beside us. And she could see one running from tree to tree as we were going, and it followed us all the way out. And that's what happened that night, and that was really kind of scary at the same time. Same time, it was just like, wow, I can't believe we actually experienced that because that thing just didn't want us to leave.
What happened that night? That you tried taking that night. Did any of them come out with anything that could be distinguished?
On one of them, you can actually see when we shine the light on one of them, the trees there. You can tell there was something standing there. And the color of the hair looked like a brownish to a reddish color looking hair. And it looked like it was not like real mangled hair or anything like that. It looked like it was long and it looked pretty groomed. You know,
she said he looked good. He looks really good. He was groomed.
Yeah.
We're not talking about, you know, scruffy, matted, stinky, nasty sort of thing.
No. You know, it did smell bad, but as far as the hair, it looked pretty groomed. And it was pretty tall. Pretty tall.
Mm-hmm.
And it was standing right behind a aspen tree. And you know how small, like I said, how those small the trunk of the aspen trees are. They're really small. We got a good view of the backside. I'm not too sure if I still. I know I have the picture somewhere. I'll have to just dig it up. It's been a while, but I do have some pictures.
Yeah, when you talk about the size being fairly tall, you're trying to get an idea of how they're built. You know, are they all built really massive and broad with thick bones, or are they more like a gazelle or a deer with kind of long limbs and able to run fast but not necessarily, you know, real massive in terms of muscling?
Well, the ones that I've seen, the one that I seen behind my house was, he was really muscular, really big, very white at the chest, long hair, black hair, and the face, we shined a flashlight on the face, and we didn't get to see the face because it was just covered in hair, just hair all over it, and the hair was long. I haven't seen, the ones that I've seen, that they're big, muscular, really big. As far as like a scraggly looking one, I haven't seen one of those. The ones like, just like I said, the ones that I've seen, they're big, tall, long arms, and they're just massive, big, muscular, muscular.
You know, and black and reddish brown seems to be the consistent colors. Now, the hair that I had found in the panhandle of Florida that, you know, I thought could have possibly been Bigfoot hair was all naturally 3 or 4 feet long, or 3 or 4 inches long, rather, not feet. You know how hair is blunt when it's cut versus tapered when it naturally is that length. And this was naturally 3 or 4 inches long. And it was reddish brown, and some of it was black. It looked like hair that had been caught as something walked down that trail at just above my shoulder height, so, you know, 4.5, 5 feet. And, you know, what it was for sure, for some reason it didn't even occur to me to take a sample home with me. I still wonder why. I mean, it was only 3 or 4 years ago, so it wasn't that long ago. I didn't care to maybe take a sample home. I dragged my husband out there and said, look, hey, you know, and we've gone back to that particular trail and area since then, and we've never found it again. So, I don't know. But, yeah, reddish brown and black was the color of the hair that I found, too. And how about you, JC? Have other colors been spotted? Did we have such a thing as a pinto hairy one?
I've heard about them. I haven't seen one. I've seen something gray, red, black, of that variety. Also, I'd like to remind you, Brenda is in the farm investigation video. It's on YouTube. Brenda's in the harvest video. You're watching Brenda and Darren gathering samples that have made it into the DNA study. You're watching it as it happens.
Is that the one with the skunk that was in the PVC pipe?
Yeah. And
folks,
Brenda
if you want to find these videos, you can find them. We've got links to them on our website, so you can go find them for find, or you can search on YouTube for Crypto Four Corners.
And come check us out. Another one of the videos was the rabbit kill, and Brenda's picking up this piece of rubber, and on one side, there's blood from inside the cage. On the other side, there's blood from someplace else. And Brenda went back and swabbed the rabbit to get a test sample and everything else. But once again, there's another piece of DNA that made it into the study from that video. So that's where we've got some really incredible things going on in these videos. You're watching us gather these samples. It's a neat thing. No one else has that.
Yeah. Well, you know, the scientific evidence to support anecdotal evidence is really important in a field like this, because it's not like the evidence is going to come from anyplace else. Now, from what I've understood in talking with you, these DNA tests are still being conducted, and you do not have the results, and they're not anticipated yet for a period of some months, right?
We do have initial results. We've got some initial exciting things as far as a paper being put together, being passed through peer review, and science academia. That's what we're waiting on right now, all of us.
Okay. That's exciting news. We will have to get you back when that actually is happening. You know, in terms of collecting this type of evidence. How do you guys hear about cases like where the skunk was killed that was in the PVC pipe and so on? Do people in the area know that you're doing this research and call you?
Well, that's,
have you made contact with law enforcement or what?
No, Brenda has an ear and an eye on those areas for the reports. We just go out there and follow up. That's all.
Mm-hmm. So, Brenda, people just know to call you?
Yes. Yes, they do. They just, when they have some things coming around their house, is when I go out and they start checking for things, and they let me know, keep me informed of what's been going on, what's, what they've been hearing, I think it is, and most of the times we find some footprints in different areas, so... Yeah.
Brenda also has a story that went on the AP, Associated Press, through the Navajo Times out there.
Uh-huh. So
one of the very few stories that have made it off of the reservation until some other people as of late. But I think the big breaking story was with Brenda with the Navajo Times and the story that they did.
Yeah. What was your story about, Brenda?
It was just basically, you know, warning the people of what's out there. And, you know, I hear a lot of, you got all these Bigfoot shows. You got Tom Biscardi, you got Matt Moneymaker, you got all of these researchers that, you know, trying to find a different, like, DNA and stuff, which is fine, and it's really cool. You got pictures and all kinds of pictures, footprints, everything. But what I haven't really quite heard is, what about the safety of the people? What are the people to, what are they supposed to do when, what if this thing actually comes and charge at them? What's going to happen? What do we do? Do we just stand there and let it come to us? This is the reason why I put that paper out there, is to let the people be aware of what's out there. Now, we also have something out here that's killing sheep, that's sucking blood out of the sheep. And people out here on the reservation, they're so puzzled. They're like, what the heck is going on? What's out here? That is the reason why I put that paper out there, is because I'm very concerned for the people's safety. And I've also mentioned to some of them that, hey, you know, this is what's going on. Is this what's happening out there? You know, they're like I said, they're like, blind. They just don't know what the heck's going on, and that's the reason why I put this article out there, is to let the people be aware and some of the things that they could possibly do that might help keep these creatures away, such as lighting. Light up your areas. Put your cat food and dog foods up, your livestock feed. Get those put up, because they eat these things. And if you keep them out, and, you know, they come in every night because they know where all that stuff is. That's what they eat. Also, I've asked them, you know, told the people, you got large weeds. Get rid of those. Chop those, because they're bedding and hiding in those. I also tell them, hey, they like to look in windows. They like women and kids. They like to hear the laughter. They really observe women. I tell them, ladies, be careful out there. Watch your kids. They imitate the kids. They try to imitate people. We've even heard them imitate different animals out here. And, you know, things that these things are doing, are trying to do, that's what I've put out there, is to be careful. You don't know. There's so many people out there saying that these things are friendly. I can read through their minds, and they can talk to me through their minds. But you know what? One day, what if one of these things turn? That's what I'm trying to get out to the people. Please, all you researchers out there, be careful. You don't know what these things are really capable of doing. That goes for myself, too. Not just
and that goes for me,
there,
too.
It goes for everybody. Everybody.
Me, too.
Yeah, be very careful out there. You know, like I said, we just don't know what these things are capable of doing. And I hate to hear if, you know, someone out in the field got hurt by one of these things. We just don't know. But that's what the article was about.
When I was young, the stories were that in the old days, you know, in the pioneering days when the houses were between, there was no such thing as telephones, et cetera, et cetera, mm-hmm. and that sometimes people wouldn't have contact with another person all winter. That Bigfoot was particularly attracted to women, especially mm-hmm. during their menstrual cycle, and that they were potential victims of mm-hmm. Bigfoot. Now, you know, in current times, no, you don't hear that particular story. Mm-hmm. But I know the old ones did. They included that part, that women... You know, I never heard a story of so-and-so got killed by a Bigfoot or anything. Just that they would be attracted to them and would become sort of a nuisance, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, guess what, folks? We have run out of time. JC, you want to give your website real quick?
Just find me on Facebook, JC Johnson. Find
okay.
Brenda
right.
on Facebook, Brenda Harris on Facebook.
Okay. And you guys can find their videos at Crypto Four Corners, and that's Crypto, CRYPTO, the number four, and then corners, the normal spelling. You search on that, and you can find it there. And there again on JC's page, as well as on Leonard Dan's page. There are videos that have been embedded there, and you can go from there to watch them. And I want to thank you both for coming on the Dawn of Shades tonight. It's been great.
Fantastic. Thank you. God bless you.
Yeah. So, folks, we are out of time. And as usual, it's happened all too quickly. I hope that tonight's program has given everyone plenty of food for thought, as well as more illumination for your personal journey towards truth. Join us again next week as we return for another fascinating conversation with Scott Pittman about permaculture. And don't forget that on April 10th, we're going to start off with our Native American Voices series that will run through June 5th. So keep tuning in each Tuesday night from 7 to 9 Central. And tonight you've been listening to The Dawn of Shades, and I'm your host, Gia Scott, and good night.